You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 10th of February 2014 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show,
I think we've got to do something to make it stick together, because you can be pretty sure that if it does start to gain altitude, the Russians will be working behind the scenes to try to torpedo it.
So that would be great, I think, to help glue this thing and have the UN help glue it. And, you know, f*** the EU.
No, exactly.
Who leaked the Newland conversation? I'll be discussing Ukraine and Russia's relationship with the West with John Everard and Gavin McFadgen. We'll also review how political rhetoric is stirring things up in Asia and what makes for successful peace talks when it comes to Syria. Then we change tack entirely and hear from Willy Bogner, designer of Germany's Olympic kit.
Our colours have nothing to do with rainbows, so just to compare it with a rainbow, I think it needs a lot of fantasy.
All that, plus our correspondent in Rio, Sheena Roster, runs through the day's news from Brazil, and Charlotte Burns reviews the week's art exhibitions in New York. That's Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, right now. So lots coming up in the next hour here on Midori House. But before all that, here's Paul Osborne with the latest news.
A further 300 civilians have escaped the besieged Syrian city of Homs as peace talks on the country's civil war resume in Geneva. The Syrian Red Crescent says they've been evacuated the day after a temporary ceasefire ended, but little progress is expected at the second round of talks on the crisis. So far, the two sides have not met face to face. The opposition wants representatives of the Syrian regime to explicitly accept the need for a transitional government. Opposition spokesman Mansur Akbik says it's vital.
Then we submitted also another paper talking about our vision to the political solution by transition to a transitional governing body. This is what Geneva communique says, and the vision shows that as a transitional governing body should be able to end the violence and take the country towards reconciliation and democracy.
The former Congolese rebel leader Bosco Ntaganda has spent the day before the International Criminal Court, accused of war crimes a decade ago. He denied ordering troops to kill and rape civilians and the forced recruitment of child soldiers. The court must decide if there is enough evidence against Ntaganda for him to stand trial. The chief prosecutor Fatou Bensouda says the man known as the Terminator spread terror across the country.
These were carefully planned, coordinated and executed campaigns of violence deliberately targeting the Lendu and Giti populations and other non-Hema ethnic groups.
France and Germany have warned Switzerland will face a series of problems after the narrow vote to restrict migration from EU countries. The country must now renegotiate deals with officials in Brussels after Sunday's referendum result, and without agreement, Swiss access to the single European market could be curtailed. Protests have continued in Bosnia for a sixth day. Demonstrators are angry at allegations of corruption and high levels of unemployment. Government buildings have been set on fire in the past week, and one minister has admitted that action against corruption is essential. Britain's Foreign Secretary William Hague says it shows the need for Europe to help Bosnia move forward.
I think what happened there is a wake-up call to the European Union and to the international community. We need to focus more effort on helping Bosnia towards the European Union, towards NATO membership, so that the stagnation in Bosnian politics and government can come to an end.
EU foreign ministers have been meeting in Brussels, where the representative from the Czech Republic said that Europe must be prepared to impose sanctions on Ukraine if it continues to use violence against protesters. He said it was unacceptable to see human rights being violated on the borders of the European Union. The UN's nuclear watchdog says there's been good progress at the latest talks with Iranian officials, but they've also said there's still a great deal to do to allay international concerns about Tehran's nuclear program. Iran continues to deny allegations that it's trying to produce atomic weapons, but it has agreed to give the IAEA greater access to the country. The film director Gabriel Axel has died at the age of 95. After 35 years in the industry, he rose to international prominence with the 1987 film Babette's Feast, which won the Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Paul. And Paul will be back at the bottom of the hour with another news roundup. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and we can be right back after this.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London, 这是 Monocle 24.
London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, Europe.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House, and it's currently 18.06 here in London, which means it's 13.06 in New York. And joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is John Everard, former British ambassador to North Korea, Belarus and Uruguay, not all at the same time, I might point out, and Gavin McFadgen, director at the Centre for Investigative Journalism in London. Welcome both to the programme. Now, we've already played it in the menu for the show, but it is a bit too juicy, so we're going to play it one more time. Here is Victoria Nuland with her moment of fame.
I think we've got to do something to make it stick together, because you can be pretty sure that if it does start to gain altitude, the Russians will be working behind the scenes to try to torpedo it.
So that would be great, I think, to help glue this thing and have the UN help glue it and, you know, f*** the EU.
No, exactly.
Well, I must say there's a few diplomats in this room and they all laughed at that moment, because we're going to begin looking at Ukraine, because last week that leaked telephone conversation aired. It's the new US ambassador to Europe, Victoria Nuland, outlining her reservations and her thoughts on the EU. Western divisions are certainly useful for Russia when it comes to Ukraine, which has been beset by pro-EU protests for months now. John, we're going to start with you. You had the biggest laugh there. Yeah. Not a great moment for Ms. Nuland.
That is a masterly understatement. What on earth was she thinking of? I mean, we all have conversations like that in the trade. This kind of thing goes on all the time. We do not, absolutely not, have conversations like that over an open mobile telephone line. Of course the Russians were listening. I mean, Victoria Nuland would have been deeply insulted if the Russians did not tap her telephone. I mean, she's a person of some standing, after all. And she says that over an open line? Putin can't have believed his luck. I mean, talk about own goals. It's the kind of thing where in the British service, if you do that, you find yourself cleaning lavatories the rest of your career. And I think we'll be watching very carefully to see if Assistant Secretary Nuland ever gets anywhere near Deputy Secretary now.
Well, she may become the director of the state apparatus after this. I think the Snowden Broadcasting Service, I think, would have been responsible for something similar.
So do you think that she's probably got the loo brush already?
I think so. I would imagine so. I'd be quite surprised, even in the State Department, if that didn't happen.
Do you think, John, back in Washington, she would have had her knuckles wrapped for that? Or is that...
Try boiled in oil.
This is something coming up from one of your previous postings, maybe. But now let's get on to the divisions that are obviously at play here. So it's clear that there is not a kind of a synchronicity of thought between the Americans and the Europeans.
So what is news?
Okay.
This is the way it always plays out. There is a kind of an almost unspoken belief in the populace at large that the West, with capital W, sort of marches forwards, firm and united. It's never like that. We always argue with the Americans over everything. It's just part of life. And the debate that we've got a few handles on coming out of these two leaks now shows knows, a difference of views, absolutely, but a constructive one. The Europeans going in with what you might call soft diplomacy, and the Americans saying, no, let's go and hit these guys, sanctions. Now, this is no surprise. Remember, Victorian Nuland's views on this are on the record, not just after this leak, but in any case, this woman is married to Robert Kagan, whose views on European soft power have been printed at great length and in acid detail for a long time. So the American view is not surprising at all. In the ordinary run of things, what happens is that the two sides sort of fight each other to a standstill, reach a kind of, well, if not a consensus, at least a position everybody can live with, and then move forward. It's going to be much harder to do this now that the world in general has been listening to the debate in progress.
Now, Gavin, they are attempting to negotiate something while the Sochi Games are on. There's some belief, I think, in the US that if they can get kind of some deal in place with the EU now, while Putin is kind of having to smile painfully, often against his will, at lots of foreign visitors in Sochi. While he's having a good show in Sochi, he's not going to be wanting to do anything too mean to Ukraine to detract from his kind of PR glory. Do you think that's true?
I think it is true. I think that nothing overt will happen. No armored cars will be on the streets, at least for the next month or
so. But even sanctions or so?
I think sanctions are unlikely under the circumstances. I mean, because it would cause a tremendous... Sanctions hit children. And they hit the defenseless. And that was the last thing I think that Putin would want to have demonstrated to anywhere. So I think it's unlikely. I think the difficulty is that the proxy war, which is actually going on, and that's really what it is in one form or another, is unclear. We don't know what the forces are that are really manipulating and mobilizing some sections of this dispute. Not all of it, but some sections.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think there's another point. That Putin's hand this time around is much weaker than the last time he had a bust-up with Ukraine. Mm. In particular, threatening to cut the gas off is really not an option for him now. Gazprom is financially very weak. Also, important to remember that the rapprochement with Iran has a bearing here. A few years ago, Putin could say, we'll cut your gas off and you'll freeze. Now, if he says, cut your gas off, there's a real chance that the Iranians will say, OK, we'll supply it instead. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it takes a short spur on the pipeline through Turkey, and Russia is out of business. And, of course, Putin doesn't want that.
And Gazprom isn't as strong as it was anyway, is it?
No, Gazprom has been isn't a mess. Gazprom's gas supply is desperately underinvested. They're having great trouble getting the stuff out of the ground and great trouble pumping it.
John, when you watch... Gavin, when you watch a situation like this, what do you think could be the outcome? Do you think that the EU has the guts and the money to pull off a deal? Do you think they have the willingness from the Americans to kind of like throw in a few bob to kind of make this work?
You know, it's a good question. I genuinely don't know the answer to that. I'd even find it hard to speculate because we're not clear about the balance of forces. At least I'm not clear. I don't see a clear demarcation between the battalions on each side, as it were. The political values, the economic battalions. I think the point you made, John, is right, that Gazprom cannot go forward a third time and cause havoc or threats of havoc without Iran or somebody else coming in a serious way. So it's a very tricky situation, one of the more interesting ones in that sense.
And what John, know, though, you're right, we don't yet understand the land of forces. We do have got some of the numbers. We know that the amount of money that Russia was offering was $15 billion. That's out in the open. $15 billion is a lot of money for Russia. Remember, Russia is spending $400 million a day propping up the ruble at the moment. It's in a horrible mess. It's not a huge amount of money for the EU. Mm-hmm. If it comes to a kind of to poker stakes, then the EU wins.
Mm-hmm. I thought that was about the price of one ski lift in Sochi.
Well, just about, yes.
Okay. Well, we'll move on before I cause too much controversy, because there's another area where political statements and offence have been caused, this time in a public sphere. Leaders of both Japan and the Philippines have recently drawn parallels between China's assertiveness in the region and pre-World War Germany in Europe. Gavin, again, you know, it's a very interesting thing because, you know, you watch this story unfold. Okay, we know it's painted by all the media as the good guys and the bad guys in a way. So, you know, we read about Japan and the way that the story is told, we can't help but feel that, you know, China is trying to steal something off Japan, the way the story gets presented. There's no kind of nuance in there. So China is always seen as the bad guy. But here we have the Americans saying, actually, hold on, you know, none of this language is very helpful if we're looking for a real solution in the area. Why do you think the Americans are so keen to kind of intercede and say to everybody, you know, cool it guys, as it were?
Well, I think there's a degree of military arrogance in it. They have a high degree of control over their own forces. They're not so certain of the control of the Philippine forces or even Japanese forces, who haven't been involved in combat for a long time. And interestingly, Tojo and Hirohito, that regime was not in a position to name Hitler as a bad guy when they were in alliance with him for a long time and hardly accusing the Chinese of it at the same time. I think it's a complicated one, just like the other, because the United States tries to play off, in a certain Cold War sense, all those divisions again, but it can't do it in quite the same way. Like, for example, you don't employ al-Qaeda in one country and then denounce al-Qaeda in another, which is exactly what's going on now. And I think with Japan and the United States, it's often very similar. They're after all, economic competitors. And I think that what they're frightened of is that what a normal commercial dispute could escalate into something rather ugly. And I think that's a real possibility in their thinking. Yeah. From the military point of view.
Could I just make a point here? When you talk about the Americans saying this is not the Americans corporately saying it. This is Carlyle.
That's right.
This is one American general. It is noticeable that when Abe drew the parallel with Europe 1914, and when Aquino talked about the parallels with Europe in the 1930s, the American reaction was a meaningful silence. They were not going to challenge these interpretations. Largely, I think, because a lot of very senior American academics recognized that Abe, at least, was right. The parallels between Europe 1914 and what's going on in East Asia now are creepy. And it is telling that every time someone draws those parallels, the Chinese jump up and down and try to deny them. They're clearly very uncomfortable with historical parallels, understandably so.
But what do you take of this idea that it isn't actually very helpful in the end of the day to try and present it as the good guys and the bad guys? Because it's too simplistic, isn't it, for the world of diplomacy?
Of course, the whole thing is shades of grey. But I think Abe, frankly, was doing the world a service in that wake-up call in Switzerland. Not good guys, bad guys. It's quite clear whose military build-up it is that's causing these tensions and who it is whose strident diplomacy has been stoking the flames. I believe that Abe should not have gone to the Asakuni Shrine. That was an error of judgment and that has inflamed people. But that apart, Japan has actually behaved in a very measured and very responsible way. And so have the Philippines. You know, it's always comforting to be able to say, well, it's everybody's fault, really. In this case, I think there is one country who is very clearly much more to blame than the others.
Gavin, it's great to have right on your side, but might on your side is slightly better, isn't it? And the Chinese have that.
Well, at the moment, they have a high degree of it. But don't forget the world's largest power, which is equal to all the rest of the world put together, is right in the middle of this dispute. I mean, they have more aircraft carriers than the whole rest of the world together, and they're all pointed at China. So I think in a certain symbolic sense, they know what the balance of forces is, and it's not Japan, it's the United States from a military point of view. Yeah. I mean, the other thing I think it has to be said is that in First World War, I think what you're saying is largely right. The First World War, we're talking about economic empires, that when they fractured, there'd be booty for all. That's not true anymore. And I think the economic rivers running into that area are very complex and multicolored. So I think it's very hard to figure out how you would advantage a destruction in China if you were Japanese or vice versa.
John, for me,
absolutely. Can I just pick up a point there? Yes, if you put the United States into the equation, of course, the military balance tilts heavily against China. One of the most frightening aspects of this whole situation is that if you talk to senior Chinese military, they all appear to be convinced that the United States would not enter a shooting war on the side of Japan. They've written the United States out of the equation. They see this as a China versus Japan, and they think they can win that. This is a very frightening miscalculation. Of course, you know, the United States is bound by legally binding treaties to defend Japan if it is attacked, and China simply doesn't see that.
John, just before we take a quick break, when you were sitting in Pyongyang, you've seen the machinations of the Chinese. In the end, what often seems to happen is that they've kept quiet or they've kind of gone about their world vision in a way to do business, to make money, to make cash. They've got a huge population that they need to feed with, you know, white goods and gosh knows what. In the end, do you think that when they look at that possibility of war with Japan or of a skirmish even, there is a lot of rhetoric and a lot of kind of, you know, we've seen these zones being called, etc. But at the end of the day, they certainly don't want to get into an escalation that leads to a proper military clash.
If only I could agree. I think I know all kinds of Chinese from different walks of life, and the great majority of these people, you know, if the decision were in their hands, there's absolutely no way that they would go to war with Japan or anybody else. They've got huge challenges at home. They want to be able to live decently. They want to build out their country. The problem is that policy is being driven, apparently, by senior Chinese military who have their own very particular worldview. And one of the things that frightens me is that you hear some of them saying that a war just now would be no bad thing.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. We're going to take a break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, John Everard and Gavin McFadgen. When we return, it's going to be peace talks and not just in the studio.
The Globalist provides insight and analysis of the key news and business stories in Europe and the Middle East. Informed, engaging and authoritative, it's a 60-minute bulletin of news, features and opinion. Two presenters in London are joined by guests in our studio and all around the world, including Monocle's editors and friends in our Hong Kong and Tokyo bureau.
Monocle's Asia editor-at-large, Kenji Hall, joins us now from Tokyo. Can you explain a little bit about this turnaround in price?
The Globalist also features an extended daily newspaper review with a special guest here in Midori House.
They're claiming that these are going to be the most compact games of all time.
And of course, we round up the business headlines with an expert analyst in a key city. Plus, don't forget the Daily Monologue, an op-ed piece from one of Monocle's globe-trotting editors. From the sublime to the occasionally ever so slightly ridiculous, find out what the minds inside Midori House are thinking. All that and more every weekday at 6 a.m. London time on The Globalist.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is former British Ambassador John Everard and Gavin McFadgen, Director of the Centre for Investigative Journalism. Round one of the Geneva peace talks made little discernible ground towards striking up a peace deal in Syria. With the talks held entirely in public view, the focus of installing a ceasefire in Homs was agreed upon actually after the talks and has since broken down in many places. Round two, though, resumes today with one difference. UN Arab League envoy Lakhdar Brahimi is holding independent talks with each side in private. Was there actually any merit in conducting the first talks in public? Gavin.
I think I defer to the ambassador here for that, because it's a procedural matter. It's not only a procedural matter, it's also a very delicate matter. One of the reasons why it's, again, in some of these subjects, quite difficult to talk with any depth is because, again, the proxy war is going on. And it's very hard to know in the proxy war in Syria exactly how the United States is faring with its nefarious allies. I mean, you can't engage al-Qaeda to fight for you on one front and then conduct a vicious war against them and them against you in another. I mean, it doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. And that's exactly what's going on in Syria in one form or another. But I defer to you.
John, was it useful?
Yes, it was useful. I think in these long drawn out negotiations, and this, believe me, is going to be long and drawn out. I mean, don't expect results anytime soon. There's a place both for conversations in private and for conversations in public. And, you know, the experts argue.
But tell me what the benefit of the public bit is.
It means you can get out in the open, put in the public domain where you stand at the outset. It helps you to square your lines, as it were, with your team back home to show that you're doing your job, you're saying the right things. And it helps you to explain to world opinion where you're coming from. And in these days, of course, that is increasingly important. You cannot, though, get into the nitty-gritty of negotiations with cameras pointing at you. That has to be done in private. And I'm sure that's why Brahimi has suggested that this time round, he takes the delegations off in private, as it were, to talk to them.
I wonder what's interesting as well is, I guess, again, these things are presented in such simplistic terms, peace talks, it's not really the idea of an ultimate solution we're talking about at the moment. It's tiny steps, isn't it? So first is this idea that, that people could get out of Homs, and people have got out of Homs. So even though there hasn't been, you know, a big conclusion that, you know, decides, you know, Bashar al-Assad, you know, here's your suitcases, we'll see you another time. Actually, we're beginning to see that there is something between both sides. They can talk to each other. Do you think that's the benefit also of it, John?
Yes. I mean, putting two people together in a room who hate each other, and then let's get them to talk, that is progress. Even if they simply exchange obscenities, we've actually got them putting, you know, got face-to-face contact. And if you work at that over a period, you can sometimes achieve at the beginning quite small results, but after a period of time, when you've got some kind of confidence that the other side is serious, it's possible to achieve major breakthroughs. Whether we're going to get there this time around, how long it might take, I don't think anybody knows.
No, indeed. I'd be rather more pessimistic as a prognosis of that, simply because the difficulties of in any civil war in which one side is alleged to have conducted enormous atrocities, and probably did, and the other side was denied conducting the atrocities and probably was involved in them, means that no side can command any kind of moral high ground in this kind of dispute. And therefore, it's not so easy to attract political allies when you don't, when everybody's saying, but you murdered 400,000 people. It's very, very difficult, I think. So that's why I think, as you say, it's going to be a very protracted war.
Yes. It is going to be a protracted war and a protracted set of negotiations. Yeah. And, I mean, we come back every time that they gather in Geneva to see if anything newsworthy has emerged. It's going to be, frankly, a long time before any kind of headline material does emerge.
Yeah. We're going to quickly look at another story, which we're going to try and fit in two stories. We're going to do these both very quickly. First, the UN nuclear watchdog is looking into suspicions that Iran began working on an atomic bomb the day after Tehran pledged to start addressing that very issue. It's important to note that the IAEA's investigation into the possible military dimensions of Iran's nuclear capability are separate to the wider diplomacy between Iran and the US allies. Again, Gavin, do we really know what's going on? Is it likely that Tehran still wants to kind of keep its finger, you know, its hand in with, you know, having a program in some, you know, until something comes out of this, it sees more cash flowing into its coffers?
I think that's a factor. And I think also that the United States itself is divided as to what to do in Iran. And that's reflected in a curious admission a couple of months back when the State Department did admit that the overthrow of Mossadegh had occurred and had occurred because of Kermit Roosevelt leading a CIA delegation and having spent only $25,000 to overthrow an entire government. Now, they had always denied this before. They'd always done nothing. And shortly after that, the Iranians began to make some concessions. So in my mind, there was some connection between the two. We don't know whether that's true or not, but it certainly sounded as though it was true.
Mm-hmm. Your view, do you think that Tehran is playing games, or do you think we still have to take what they're doing at face value?
I don't think they're so much playing games, but I think the chances of the current investigation into whether or not there was a military intent behind the Iran nuclear program is doomed to failure. I think it would all be fascinating to know what the truth is, but there is no way that the Iranians are ever going to allow a UN investigative team to discover a smoking gun. There's too much Iranian prestige riding on this. And if, on the other hand, the team came back and said, actually, we see no evidence that there ever was a wish to build a bomb, most of the Western world would simply bin the report. I mean, I think it's one of those things that is going to take some time and finally get nowhere. The real theatre isn't in this investigation. It's in these on-off negotiations between the two sides that we're seeing.
John, you mentioned a word that's completely off the schedule, but we're going to chuck that in for the last 2 minutes. Marius the giraffe.
Marius the ex-giraffe.
Ex-giraffe, killed in the Copenhagen Zoo. Quick question, is there a role for zoos these days, and should the public boycott zoos that kill their animals? Same has happened in the UK, 6 lions killed at Longleat. Is there a place for the zoo today?
Yes, there is a place for the zoo, but not for zoo management that simply doesn't understand the reaction of killing an unfortunate, healthy, rather lovable giraffe in cold blood and then vivisecting him, or dissecting rather. In front of children. I mean, for heaven's sake, what was the zoo director thinking of? I mean, in purely scientific terms, this might make sense, but zoos depend on public approval and they depend on public donations coming through the turnstiles and in other forms of support. Copenhagen Zoo has just blown that comprehensively.
I think it's also so that Private Eye has said that if you want to watch the zoo in action, you can go to Parliament. And I think there's an element of truth. It's not much different in many ways, but I agree with you. It's
do you think they'll start shooting giraffes in Parliament? Wow.
But Gavin, do you think that the zoo is a Victorian kind of hangover that we should get rid of?
Yes, I think it probably is. But it's delightful for children. Why shouldn't they have it?
Well, unless you see the kind of the giraffe being fed to the lions today, a huge giraffe steaks for all there. Well, gentlemen, we're going to have to leave it there. We've gone off piste a little bit there, but who cares? John Everard and Gavin McFadden, thank you very much for joining us on Midori House.
Cheers. London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty still to come then in the second half of today's Midori House. Our Rio de Janeiro correspondent Sheena Roster runs us through the day's news in Brazil, and we hear from the designer behind Germany's rather colourful Olympic kit, Willy Bogner. But before we get started on all that, here's Paul Osborne with the latest world news headlines.
As peace talks on Syria's civil war resume in Geneva, another 300 civilians have managed to escape from the besieged city of Homs. The Syrian Red Crescent says they were evacuated the day after a temporary ceasefire ended, but little progress is expected at the second round of talks on the crisis. The two sides have not met face-to-face today. The former Congolese rebel leader Bosco Ntaganda has spent the day before the International Criminal Court, accused of war crimes a decade ago. He denied ordering troops to kill and rape civilians and the forced recruitment of child soldiers. France and Germany have warned Switzerland it will face a series of problems after the narrow vote to restrict migration from EU countries. The country must now renegotiate deals with officials in Brussels. Without agreement, Swiss access to the single European market could be curtailed. For a sixth day, protests have continued across Bosnia. Demonstrators are angry at allegations of corruption and high levels of unemployment. Government buildings have been set on fire in the past week. One minister has admitted that action against corruption is essential. And the UN's nuclear watchdog says there's been good progress at the latest talks with Iranian officials, but they've also said that there's still a great deal to do to allay international concerns about Tehran's nuclear activities. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Paul. And Paul's going to be back in another 30 minutes with a full bulletin of world news. It's currently 18:32 here in London. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. And it's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. And today is the turn of Sheena Roster, our correspondent in Brazil. A little earlier, I spoke to her in Rio de Janeiro.
Santiago Andrade, who's 49 years old, he was announced brain dead earlier today. He's a cameraman for TV Bandeirantes, and basically this incident actually happened last Thursday in the center of Rio de Janeiro. He was hit in the head with a flare that police shot directly at him. It hit him, it grazed right by his left ear and basically immediately knocked him to the ground. He underwent emergency surgery immediately after a four-hour procedure, which was looking to basically ease up the pressure that he's dealing with on his cranium. But today, early this morning, police did announce that 90% of the left side of his brain is without circulation and that he is pretty much completely brain dead.
And tell me, what's the reaction of the public to this?
It's a pretty strong reaction. This is pretty shocking. Of course, he wasn't wearing a helmet, and a lot of the journalists that do go to cover these things, they're just as fully armed as much as the police with helmets, gas masks, and goggles. But personally, I was actually at this protest myself as well. And it did start out quite a peaceful protest. It was a protest basically against the rises in bus fares, which we've been seeing in several Brazilian cities over the past few months and which initially started all the protests back in June. And it started out peaceful at Candelaria and everybody worked their way down Avenida Presidente Vargas. However, when everybody arrived at the central station, which is the main bus hub, train hub, and metro hub of the city when protesters tried to jump the barriers in order to ride the bus for free. Within 5 minutes, it completely took a 180 and basically turned really violent, and the police were trying to break up the crowd with tear gas and with these flares. Obviously, it's not reacting well in the public, because this man, he wasn't just a journalist, he was a cameraman. He had a massive camera on his shoulder, and he was hit directly by the police. And the pictures that have been shown in O Global newspaper are pretty explosive, where it shows the image of the flare, basically just an explosion around what looks like legs, because you can't even see the man, that the explosion that hit him was so big.
Now, these protests had, first of all, died down, and then they slightly came back. Then we saw all these kind of youth kind of demonstrations in shopping malls, and now they seem to be back on the street again. Is it quite a difficult situation for authorities in cities such as Rio to kind of keep a grip of?
They are definitely coming back, and they're expected to remain, especially during the World Cup, when the whole world will be focusing its attention on Brazil. I think what is becoming a difficult balance, and what is almost fueling the fire for more of these protests, is the way that the police are policing these protests. Some say with too much of a heavy hand, which is a good example of this cameraman getting shot with a flare. It's not the responsibility of the government, or it's not necessarily that the police are policing in as of a responsible manner, but it's just kind of striking that delicate balance, which they have so far struggled to do.
Now, Sheena, it's not only Rio that has some issues connected with the World Cup. If we go to Manaus in the Amazon, they still haven't finished building the stadium. And now workers are going to go on strike because they say another worker has died there and they want better working conditions. Could you just tell us about this?
Yes, exactly. So on Friday afternoon, it was announced that a 55-year-old Portuguese worker, José Pita Martins, had died when basically a crane that he was dismantling fell on his head. The crane was being used to assemble the remaining sections of the stadium's roof. He didn't die immediately on impact, but he died shortly after when he arrived in hospital. These workers are basically threatening to go on strike over safety conditions because they have been working around the clock in order to get the stadium done on time. Of course, this latest accident has shut down the site for about a week, and that's going to just delay it even more. It's already missed its December 31st deadline, and it was expected to be inaugurated this coming week. Obviously, it's not going to be inaugurated, and it was 97% complete at the time of this accident. So if workers do go on strike, it's hard to say when the stadium will be inaugurated. Of course, this is not good for FIFA, which FIFA had made it very clear from the start that they would not be accepting the delays around stadium deliveries that happened during the Confederations Cup. They would not accept it during the World Cup. But so far, only 7 of the 12 stadiums have been completed and delivered.
Now, we're not keeping things very cheerful today, I admit, but there's another football story, and this one's tough as well. A player nearly got strangled last week. What's going on?
Yes, exactly. So basically, fans have been quite hard on their team. It's one fan base in particular, the Corinthians, which is one of the biggest fan bases in the whole country. They have about 30 million fans throughout the whole country. Basically, their team hasn't been doing that well. They did very well 2 years ago when they won the Club World Cup, beating out Chelsea. But this time, they're not happy. So they broke in last week into one of the training facilities, actually the training facility that Iran is going to be using in Sao Paulo during the World Cup. They cut the chain link fence, stormed the field, and managed to strangle Paulo Guerreiro, basically saying that he should be doing better. And because of all this, it's really created an uproar, with some players actually asking to be traded because they fear for their safety. One good example of that is Alexandre Pato, who used to play for AC Milan. He is playing for Corinthians, and he recently got traded to Sao Paulo because he was fearing for his safety, because he has had such a poor performance himself since he arrived on this team that he was worried that some of these fans might attack him as well.
Well, finally, just to make sure we don't get a nice call from the Brazilian Tourist Board, tell us about people having their kidneys and bladders stolen.
Yes, this is a really bizarre story, but two doctors have been jailed in Brazil after selling contraband organs to the U.S. as part of a suspected human organ trafficking scheme. So Celso Roberto Safai and Claudio Carneiro Fernandes are two urologists, which, for most people who don't know, those are doctors who specialize in the kidney and bladder. They were working in the state of Minas Gerais, and basically they got caught selling kidneys, livers, other organs, and other body tissues that were illegally removed from patients. Of course, they were originally convicted last year in February, but they appealed to a higher court in order to try to get off. However, the court upheld the original ruling last Thursday, and the two men immediately went behind bars in a city 500 kilometers from Belo Horizonte, the capital of Minas Gerais.
Well, that was Sheena Roster in Rio de Janeiro talking to me a little bit earlier today. Up next, we'll speak to the man behind Germany's Winter Olympic kit, Willy Bogner. Stay tuned to find out more on this episode of Midori House on Monocle 24.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on shows you might have missed. You can download programs to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders of all your favourites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants, and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favourites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Instapaper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. The Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Monocle 24 is your 24-hour-a-day international radio service. Based in the heart of London, with contributions from our bureau in Hong Kong, Tokyo, New York, Toronto and Zurich, and reporters in more than 30 countries, we broadcast a mix of news, discussion, features, reportage, reviews, music and more. From retail to travel, food to urbanism, business to film, Monocle 24 has it covered.
One of the things that I would like to allude to, which is very much the kind of thing that you're doing here, is you're having this kind of discussion. But the discussion that needs to take place, where the forward thinking needs to come from, is from the brains trusts and the think tanks, and they're not doing it.
To call it an international conference, that's difficult in itself. The really difficult thing is then to start to implement the conclusions.
I was actually the last correspondent to send dispatches by carrier pigeon. It's not something I'm proud of.
There are two kinds of games. The games that uses the city, and the other kind is the city that uses the games.
Plus, our carefully curated playlist is the soundtrack to your day, stretching from Stockholm to Sydney, Brooklyn to Bogota.
It was like entering the gates of heaven.
You can hear us live at monocle.com, catch up with anything you may have missed on our Time Shift player, download our bespoke app for your smartphone, and hear it all on iTunes.
I like the sense that you just have no idea where it's going to go.
Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. It's currently 18:42 here in London. Well, the Winter Olympics present an opportunity for designers to try out some fairly outlandish new lines. And Sochi is no exception. On the sporting catwalk, you have such soon-to-be classics as the US team's Ralph Lauren cardigan, the mariachi ski suit of Mexico, Norway's zigzag curling outfit, and of course, Germany's rainbow-infused national kit. I caught up with this iconic designer and former Olympian himself, Willy Bogner, to find out what was behind the team's stripes.
To be correct, our colours have nothing to do with rainbows. They are just four colours that are inspired by the location of Sochi, and there's two colors missing from the rainbow, and the organization of the colors is completely different. So just to compare it with the rainbow is I think it needs a lot of fantasy.
Now tell me, this isn't the first time that you've designed the kit for the Winter Olympics team for Germany. What is the process you go through? What are you trying to look for when you send the team out?
To be precise, it's the 19th time we do this since 1936, and we know the job very well. The main objective is to make the team look, number one, very positive in their emotional appearance, and number two, obviously, also to stand out against all the other nations, also in the fashion sense. And we are in the Winter Games, which happen on a wide canvas. So we have always tried to be outstanding in our design and very colorful. We've done this in the last 10 games, and all the athletes and officials love it. So to stand out, to project the positive feeling of the games. So we are very happy with the design, and obviously it's always subject of discussion, which anybody can comment on.
Willy, you've had an amazing career yourself, including twice appearing in the Winter Olympics yourself.
That's correct, yes.
When you're designing these outfits, does it help you in the sense that you know, you know, what skiers want to stay warm, etc.?
Yes, of course. I mean, I was 18 in my first Olympic Games in Squaw Valley, and I will never forget that experience. And it's a very, very special day for every athlete, especially the first time. And also to represent that first, and, you know, this moment of acceleration, of party, you know, it's a big, it's Olympic Games. It's a very positive and very playful atmosphere, despite all the pressure on the athletes. But it's that moment where you go out and you show the world that you love it, you love your sport, and you love to be part of that international community.
Now, we've seen the whole fashion industry change around sportswear. I think there was a piece just this week in Bloomberg saying actually on the sports side of running and things, you know, that many of the big fashion shows this season had been inspired by the world of sport. But certainly in the world that you dominate, you're one of the biggest brands out there. If you go to a Samaritz, you'll certainly see a store with your name above the front door. Just tell me, is this world of, you know, ski wear, it's booming, isn't it?
Yeah, it's fantastic because, you know, sports has become a part of our lifestyle in general, and it's a mega trend that's going to be there forever. People want to be more active, they want to be outside, they want to be in good shape, they want to be healthy. So this is one mega trend, and the other is high quality. Some people call it luxury, we call it, you know, just a premium brand attitude, which requires great attention to detail. And to be very special, we do more than 1,700 styles a year to be very special for our customers. And people love it. We are in a very good position right now with our brands, and it's all very positive.
And Willy, tell me what the support team is that you have to send to Sochi with all these great athletes there. Your kit needs to be in its, you know, its best shape. Do you send a whole team from your company to make sure that everyone has a, you know, an alternative outfit fit in case they fall and tear it, or if they destroy it somehow?
Yes, of course. But one of the important points is that every athlete feels that it's his personal style, and we measure every athlete of the like 250 people. And make it to measure. So they feel it's their outfit. And we know from our own experiences, the outfits will remain with us forever as a memory of these games. So it has a very, very, very important message also after the games.
And finally, Willy, when you watched all the teams coming out and you saw your great kit on them, did you think you were the gold medal winner?
You know, I mean, taste is always a big subject, but for everybody involved, the athletes, the officials, the spectators in the stadium, I think, and also the reaction to the team was very, very positive. So we are in the medal ranks. if we go to France, you know, that's always the question. But we definitely were one of the more outstanding, also fashion-wise.
Well, that was the designer of the German Winter Olympic kit, Willy Bogner, who was speaking to me a little bit before we came on air. Well, strap on your skates and get ready to do an arabesque. We're heading out on the ice for a bit of music and a bit of a dance. This is David Bowie with Fashion.
We are the Goon Squad and we're coming to town. Beep, beep. Beep, beep.
Well, that was David Bowie's Fashion there. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and we're fast approaching the end of the programme. But before we go, we have time for our daily review segment. And today, we talk art with Charlotte Burns, art market and business editor of the Art Newspaper, who joins us from our New York bureau. Welcome to the show, Charlotte. I want to jump straight in with the Mike Kelly show that's on at MoMA. Now, Mike Kelly is, I guess, amongst art folk, is regarded as one of the most important artists of our time. Perhaps didn't quite get the public fame, though, that he deserved.
Well, that's part of the reason I was so interested to see the show, is because I never studied contemporary art. I studied modern art, and I knew about Mike Kelly through working in the art world, but I'd never really seen enough of his work to understand why he was so critically acclaimed. So this show really is, it's the largest ever show of his work. He committed suicide last year, so, you know, it's sort of a homage to his output as well. And it was huge. It's a 40,000 square foot exhibition. It's gargantuan and sprawled over MoMA PS1, which is the museum in Queens. And it's a really good opportunity to sort of get your head around why Kelly matters so much to people in the know.
So for people who are not in the know, we're not talking about small, pretty paintings on walls. These are big pieces. One of them, which I thought maybe the Campanus brothers may have seen once before, the sewn together teddy bears and hanging from the ceilings. These are giant pieces, aren't they?
These are giant pieces. What really struck me, though, upon seeing the show was how much he made and how many different, he was really a Gesamtkunstwerk. You walk around and there's sculptures, there's drawings, there's bird boxes, there's texts, textiles, dolls, cuddly toys sewn into masses, satellites hanging from ceilings, objects on walls that emit a sort of deodorant spray. It's really wide-ranging and constantly touching on these messy themes of, you know, black humour and domesticity and maleness, and under it all really is a sort of undercurrent of violence.
And you came away feeling that he deserved that 40,000 square feet?
Yeah, I did. There were a few things I'd like to have seen more of. There's the installation room Day is Done, 2005, was really impressive. It's a room full of screens and these installations, all kinds of noises going on, and they're basically recreations of high school yearbook photos. And this idea of returning to adolescence is something that runs through Kelly's work. So it's interesting to see it in that format, and I'd like to have seen more of that kind of work and perhaps less of the later Candor projects, which is based on the Kryptonite city where Superman was born, which were great, but there was just a lot of them, and perhaps it would have been nice to see something else.
Now, over at the Guggenheim, they have a Christopher Wool show. Christopher Wool, whenever you see his artworks coming up in auction these days, it's a big ka-ching. He's very, very collectible, isn't he?
Yes, he is. His career has... he's a mid-career artist, and his market prices have gone bananas over the past 4 years. And this show was a chance to sort of reappraise his work, because he's really heard of it in terms of the market, like you introduced him. That's how we think of him these days. So it's nice to go to the Guggenheim and see the exhibition, which is really successful. It's a really great show, but the market did touch upon the show, because one of his most important works was a work called Apocalypse Now, made in 1998, and it's a text piece which says, sell the house, sell the car, sell the kids. And it's sort of widely thought of to be really one of his pivotal works, and it was sort of scheduled to be a centerpiece of the show, as far as I understand it. However, a former Guggenheim trustee, who's the hedge funder David Ganek, made a deal and sold the work to a private buyer, who then sold it at Christie's auction in November, where it made $26.5 million, which is a record for the artist. And the work wasn't obviously in the Guggenheim show, which was a shame, because it would have been nice to have seen it.
So again, people who are not in the know, lots of screen prints, lots of perhaps a little bit more traditional in the sense in comparison to our previous show.
Completely different than Kelly, where Kelly's sort of sprawling and chaotic. Christopher Wool is controlled and, you know, again, there's a kind of thing of violence in his work, but his is much more restrained, like a dog on a muzzle. His work really references this idea of, you know, abstraction and conceptualism, street art, graffiti. It's, it's 2D art. It's work that you could put on a wall. And it comes back to this idea of, you know, painting, where the painting is dead or not dead.
Now, Charlotte, we have but 1 minute left, but I want to find out why it's important what's happening at the Dear Art Foundation.
Well, the Dear Art Foundation isn't a temporary show, it's a permanent installation, but I just strongly recommend that anybody who comes to New York or lives here takes the train, which is an hour from the city, to see it. It's one of the best museums in the world. There are in-depth site-specific installations by, you know, Dan Flavin, Richard Serra, Michael Heiser, and it's a really wonderful art experience, although Dear itself is missing a space in Manhattan.
But it's about to lose its art director, isn't it? Its director, rather.
Philippe Verne, he was appointed in 2008, and he's leaving to go to LA MoCA and run things there. So he's leaving Dear at a time of change. People want to know when the building is going to break ground on 22nd Street. And, you know, the general feeling is that Dear Beacon is fantastic but unchanging, and it would be good to have a more current space in the middle of the city.
But finally, a good weekend then to pop over in the next one to see a lot of good shows in New York at the moment.
Always lots of art in New York. So I don't think it's ever a bad time to come and see art here.
Charlotte Burns, as always, lovely to speak to you. That was Charlotte Burns of the Art Newspaper. And thank you to her for coming on the show. And, well, that's all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, John Everard and Gavin McFadgen. Today's show was produced by Ella John, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and also by Anadi Satuma. And our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Next up is Culture with Robert Bound. He'll be joined by the German piano maestro, Niels Frahm, who tells him what prompted him to release a new book of his music entitled Sheets.
It would be nice if Bach would have taken the time and be like, hey, and maybe play it in this or that way, and be sure not to rush things. And it's all things you can't really put in the actual sheet music with all the symbols you're using.
And scrub that, thanks to Chris Chilvers. He didn't do a thing. Special thanks to Bill Loyty, who was the man behind the desk today. Don't forget, we'll be back at the same time tomorrow. But from me, Andrew Tuck, it's just time to say goodbye. Have a good Monday.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. 1 year can inspire a lifetime. Rolex.